And welcome back. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. The numbers are enough to make anyone sit up and take notice. Simply put, the cost of attending college at a public university has more than tripled in the past three decades, while the average family's income has barely budged. In fact, the cost of college is rising faster than any other good or service in America.
For private schools, that increase is much, much higher. Sticker shock is very real, and its hangover is brutal. Over $1 trillion of debt now rests on the backs of American students and former students.
And we may be coming to a point where that's no longer sustainable. That's the contention of a new film called Ivory Tower, which opened in theaters recently, directed by Andrew Rossi. Here's the opening of the film.
There are problems in all the sectors of higher education. And it's a perfectly fair expectation for students and their families to want to know that when they leave college, they're going to have some skills that somebody's going to be willing to compensate them for.
We've got a lot of people with college degrees, waiting tables, cleaning toilets, you know, driving.
Nearly half of all students are showing no significant gains in learning.
But there is an apocalyptic dimension to this as well. And that is the idea that the very concept of the institution of higher learning is about to be broken. And only a very, very small handful of colleges will survive intact on the other side of this tidal wave.
We're at the point where people are saying, maybe you don't have to go to college.
Is college worth it?
There have been moments in human history when those who said the future is going to look a lot different very soon have been right. This might be one of them.
Ivory Tower reminds us that the American higher education system is a rich tapestry of options, from elite private colleges to sprawling state universities to small alternative schools to new experiments in free online courses.
But the film raises big, unsettling questions about this system, such as, does it still provide a dependable ladder of social mobility, a pathway to the middle class, maybe even a shot at the American dream? And is it a system that remains open to all? Well, joining us now from New York is Andrew Rossi. He's director of Ivory Tower. And Andrew Rossi, welcome to Radio Boston and congratulations. I saw the film last night, incredibly provocative, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Anthony. I appreciate it.
I want to start with some history that I thought you laid out really well in Ivory Tower. And you remind us of this extraordinary promise of the American higher education system, beginning, as you do, with a little lesson from the Civil War. Congress passes the Morrill Act, which leads to the whole sprawling system of state universities across the land. Then after World War II comes the GI Bill, then the Higher Ed Act of 1965. And it all sort of fuels this idea that higher education is almost like an American public right. And if I took one message away from your film, it's that this right is really under assault now. And I'm wondering where that erosion began. Where do you sort of mark the beginning of that erosion?
Well, we see that in the 1970s, conservative governors like Ronald Reagan of California suggested that the state should not be subsidizing intellectual curiosity. And so it's in that period when state funding starts to decline. And indeed, from 1980 to the present day, we see that state funding has gone down by about 40% to public universities. It's part of a broader shift that orients the philosophy about higher education away from its role as a public good in our society, providing educated citizens in a democracy, and rather to a conception of college as the ticket to a wage premium. And indeed, that is a very enduring statistic about the value of college, the fact that median lifetime earnings for those who go to college and get a BA make about $1 million more than those who only have a high school diploma.
Right. Yeah, and you remind us in a very emphatic and dramatic way about these various forces that are bearing down on the higher ed system. Rising tuition, which you point out is rising higher than any consumer good or service by a huge factor. $1 trillion of student debt and a kind of arms race among many schools that just keep spending, building, upping their costs. So I'm just wondering, where does this lead us? Because this great quote that we just heard, where you say there have been moments in human history when people have said the future is going to look a lot different very soon, and we're right, this might be one of them. So what does it look like? You know, if this is the end of that one moment, what does it look like in the next moment, the higher ed system?
Well, I think what we see is that the financial model for higher education is broken. And it's several different factors that are coming together to create a perfect storm in which that's the case. As we said, state funding has gone down, and so many universities must capture the student loan dollar. The sort of subsidy that government provided in the past has now been taken over by student loans. And in order to attract students, universities compete with each other on the basis of frequently building campaigns to provide more luxurious student centers and dorms, in some cases research laboratories that don't have a real impact on the mass of students' academic experience. And so this financial model keeps on growing bigger and results in tuition costs being transferred to the student. With technology providing an opportunity in some cases for much less expensive skills cultivation and knowledge transfer, the question is whether we can see a future in which technology helps to disrupt this financial model that is clearly unsustainable in higher education.
Mm. And when you're talking about technology disrupting this financial model, I mean, are you talking about, for example, MOOCs, massive open online courses, experiments like Udacity and Harvard's edX? I mean, there's a lot of buzz around these technologies. Is that the kind of thing we're talking about? Because you get into that as well in the film.
Yes, that is what we look at in the film. These, in some cases, for-profit and in other cases, non-profit, for example, edX, online platforms that provide videos that students can watch and then a form of sort of peer-to-peer interaction that's powered by social media and chat rooms and quizzes that make sure that students are learning. What we found in the movie and in our research is that when the technology is combined with some form of human interaction in the flipped classroom model or the blended learning model, again, expenses can be managed in a very effective way and learning outcomes can be reinforced. Mm-hmm. But when the learning is delivered exclusively online and students don't have any interaction with professors, especially for those who need the most help, the learning outcomes can actually be much worse than the on-campus experience.
Yeah, and you talk about an experiment. San Jose University teamed up with Udacity. The results were really disappointing. On the other hand, you did sort of a nice portrayal of some stuff going on at Bunker Hill Community College, right, not far from our studios, where it was this mixture of online stuff and professors having one-on-one contact with their students, where it seemed to work out pretty well. Let me get back to another big theme, though, and that is one of the questions you raise, and that is college still worth it for everyone? And of course, this huge debt that many students are taking on raises this question. And I want to play a quick clip from your film. You'll first hear Anthony Carnevale. He's an education policy expert, followed by Stephanie, a Hunter College graduate who amassed massive student loan debt while achieving her master's degree with no job to show for it.
Once you hit $50,000 in debt, you need to pause and take a look at the value of the education you're getting. You don't want to incur debt that stops you from investing in family formation, houses, cars, and children down the road.
The value of my education is priceless, but the value of my education is also not $140,000 in debt.
So, Andrew Rossi, did you come away with sort of an answer to that question that you raise quite dramatically in the film? Is it still worth it?
Yes. In purely financial terms, again, median lifetime earnings for those who have a BA are $1 million more than those without a BA and with only a high school diploma. So on those terms, yes. However, that doesn't take into account all those who go to college but can't complete and, in fact, drop out with student loan debt, even if it is a modest amount. They're not going to have the ability to get a job that allows them to pay back that debt the way that they should. Mm. And also, there are those who are emerging with quite a bit of debt. In fact, we see a new Wall Street Journal study just a couple of weeks ago released for the class of 2014 showing that the average amount of debt is $33,000. And that is for 70% of students graduating from public and private universities. You know, $33,000 to have as a burden is going to have an impact on the choices that young people make, whether it's the type of career they choose or decisions to start a family and ultimately buy a home.
Listeners, we're talking to Andrew Rossi. He's a filmmaker, director of the new film Ivory Tower, which is now playing at the Kendall Square Cinema in Cambridge and elsewhere across the country. We want to hear from you. Are you living with this kind of debt? Do you think your education was worth it? How can we do things differently? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Call us, especially if you've seen the movie Ivory Tower. We'd love to hear from you. You can also comment on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And let me introduce Michael Horn, co-founder of the Clayton Christensen Institute and executive director of its education program. He's author, along with Clayton Christensen and Curtis Johnson, of Disrupting Class, How Disruptive Innovation Will Change the Way the World Learns. And Michael, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I'd love to know, sort of get a quick reaction. You saw this movie. What did you think about the way that Andrew Rossi sort of laid out the various, challenges that are afflicting higher education in America?
Sure thing. The challenges facing higher education right now are multifaceted in nature and extremely complex. And I thought the movie did a good job for someone coming to this problem, thinking about the depths of it for the first time, really laying out those different storylines in really good detail and giving you an overall picture or primer of all these challenges. I thought it was masterful in the way it introduced characters to make those problems also come to life in a way that I think a lot of the op-eds or studies often miss.
Mm. I was struck by two things, and that is, first of all, I thought that Andrew did just great job sort of laying out the real tapestry and the variety of experiences you can have at higher ed, but how they're all kind of being assaulted by similar forces, whether it's debt or, you know, declining state support for these institutions. So where is this going to take us? Because Andrew's talking about a tipping point. This is unsustainable.
Yeah, I think he's absolutely right. The business model of higher education at all levels, minus maybe the most elite schools, and we should characterize those differently. I think sometimes too often the conversation around higher education ignores that tapestry of colleges and just thinks about the grassy green quads and four-year residential experience at places like Harvard and MIT. Really, if you look below those 50, 200 institutions, everyone's business model is under assault right now, mm-hmm. as tuition, government dollars, contributions from alumni and endowment returns are unable to keep up with the rising costs inherent in this arms race and trying to manage research with teaching, with all the social experience. It just is a very complicated model, and the costs themselves underlying it are actually out of control.
Yeah. So, Andrew, I'd love to ask you, you know, looking at this rich tapestry of options that are out there, what did you come away with that gives you hope? In other words, you know, is it the elite private schools? Is it the state schools? Is it the small experimental free schools? Is it the sort of Cooper unions in New York that tried for years to maintain free tuition but then sort of lost that battle? Where is the hope of a system that might make sense for the future?
Well, I think as Michael rightly points out, there is a strata of elite schools at the top which have endowments large enough to sustain this type of growth, to become bigger and better, but to also provide financial aid so that students can attend, particularly in the case of Harvard, with all their needs taken care of. So, you know, at that level, higher education is still performing fantastically. What's interesting is that the Bunker Hill model that we discussed before, in which there is a flipped classroom powered by technology, also provides a lot of hope. And community colleges in general, as a part of the sector that is most willing to experiment because they have so many fewer resources, I think there's a lot of hope to be found there. You mentioned Cooper Union, which is the formerly free school in New York City. The student activists at that school who are working to counter and protest the institution of tuition at their school also give us hope, I think, as students start to become less victims, as Peter Thiel, who appears in the film, describes them, and instead try and seize the narrative and control themselves. And ultimately, that kind of conversation that they can propel will help more people to understand the unsustainability of the model.
Well, it's funny. I wanted to ask you, I mean, not funny. It's interesting that you mentioned Cooper Union, because I wanted to ask you about why you focused on Cooper Union in the film. And what I took away from that was this incredible example of student activism. So for listeners that don't know, Cooper Union historically was a school that had basically offered free tuition, but because of various investments, because of the climate that we're describing right now, they were forced to impose tuition. The students occupied the president's office for, what, 2-3 months or something like that?
65 days,
65 yes. days. And really you saw this great example of sort of student activism that sort of reminded me of the 60s. But at the end of the day, the Board of Trustees had to impose tuition. So is that a dream, sort of this dream of higher ed as being a right subsidized sort of mysteriously by some other force? I mean, are those days just behind us forever?
Well, you know, Peter Cooper established the Cooper Union in 1859 with the land under the Chrysler Building, which has now, of course, become extremely profitable and has powered the endowment for Cooper Union through two world wars and the Great Depression. The financial mismanagement that has brought down Cooper Union is such a spectacular example of this arms race, this attempt in their case specifically to build an engineering building for $175 million at a rate of about $1,000 a square foot, the equivalent for a luxury hotel. And they raised that money through a loan. And it's because of their own indebtedness now that they are saying they have to charge tuition. Another thing that gives me hope is that the students actually, through an Indiegogo campaign, have raised $100,000 to initiate a lawsuit. And they hope to get an injunction to stop the school from charging tuition. So, in fact, the story there is actually not totally over.
Interesting. Michael, I'd love to ask you about, you know, and Andrew made reference to the sort of arms race that schools are engaged in, and the enormous amounts of money that are being spent on facilities and student villages and climbing walls. This is something that we've talked about a lot over the years, but who's ultimately to blame for this? Because, you know, on the one hand, it's easy to blame the schools, but aren't they just providing what the families and the kids are sort of demanding?
Yeah, I actually think it's not a blame conversation per se. It's what we've seen in industry after industry afflicted by disruptive innovation, which is that managers and people running these institutions make the very logical decision to continue to invest in things that bring in more research dollars, make their students happier with more amenities. The challenge is that at some point you start to overshoot what your students, parents are able or willing to pay for, and they don't value those improvements. And as you do so, these lower cost alternatives are starting to come into the market. Yes, online learning is a part of it. I would argue that'll be a piece of it. It's also going to unbundle some of the place-based elements with things like General Assembly or Dev Bootcamp, co-learning spaces. And as these other alternatives start to come into the sector, people will start to piece together their higher education in radically different ways. And that's the real vulnerability right now, these institutions. Totally logical, not a blame game per se, but they're just caught in a very logical moment that leads to their demise in the longer run.
Really interesting. Let's take some calls. We've got a bunch of callers who want to get in on this conversation. Let's go to Ellen, who's calling from Medford. Hi, Ellen, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to point out, and perhaps your author could comment on this, American education has always functioned to stratify the society into classes, that is, lower middle class students going to community colleges, middle class going to state colleges, upper privileged people going to Wellesley, Harvard, my alma maters. And this situation now, however, represents a huge leap out of the box into the corporatization of higher learning, which goes along with the corporatization of the society in general and the division of the society into haves and have-nots.
All right, Ellen, I think we got the point, and I'm really grateful for the call and for you putting that on the table. Andrew Rossi, I'd love you to respond to Ellen, the sort of privatization of what used to be state funding and the further sort of stratification, I guess, of sort of the class of higher education.
Absolutely. Well, I think Ellen's words could actually be an amalgamation of different comments in the film itself. She's exactly right. And Anthony Carnevale, who appears in the film, is the head of the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce. has spoken very poignantly, I think, about this stratification. And ironically, as college becomes ever more necessary to have a job in the middle class, the stratification in terms of students who are typically white and wealthy and go to the selective admission schools, and those who are disadvantaged and African American or Latino who end up at the open access schools, becomes more and more of, in his words, a way to launder inequality. And even Governor Brown of California, Jerry Brown, says that this is part of a bigger problem in our society, the marketization or corporatization of so many things. I think really what we see very clearly in the film is that that institutions are behaving more and more like big businesses. And I think, as Michael says, it's not that they should be blamed for that as some sort of pernicious development, but rather it's the sort of logical outgrowth of these other financial factors.
Let's see if I can get one more caller into this conversation. Sarah is calling from Framingham. Hey, Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that I currently just graduated with my BA, and a few of my friends are considering the option to just continue going to school as a full-time student so that we won't have to pay any of the debt, because the rule is if you are a full-time student, you get to wait 6 months after you graduate in order to actually start paying off the debt.
So just keep going in school, keep going to school, go on and get your PhD, because as long as you're a full-time student, you don't have to pay. Michael Horn, what do you think?
Well, the day of reckoning will still come at some point. So I think the challenge, honestly, is not to keep having the conversation of how do we allow people to afford what is an expensive education, but how do we make education itself affordable so that we can make it far more accessible. I think both these last two callers point to that, which is that the current system is highly stratified, leads to some bizarre decisions about continuing to just enter education just to put off debt or other things rather than doing the family building that Tony Carnevale talks about in the movie. But the other flip side of it is I think the disruption that we're seeing emerge actually could be a great leveler for a large part of society and actually give lots of people access to a high quality education.
Well, there's a lot of there are a lot of great ideas in this film. Andrew Rossi, I want to thank you for joining us. Filmmaker, director of the new film Ivory Tower. It's now in theaters, among them the Kendall Square Cinema in Cambridge. Andrew Rossi, thank you so much for joining us.
Anthony, I really appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciated having you. And Michael Horn, he's co-founder of the Clayton Christensen Institute and executive director of its education program. Michael Horn, thanks. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, good to have you. Listeners, stay with us. Coming up from the frontiers of neuroscience, new understanding of how long-term child abuse and neglect affect the brains of children. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.